On.
It is. You need to speak up.
Testing, testing.
I have to get closer. I'm going to call the June 25th, 2019 meeting of the Mill Creek City Council to order, and let's begin with the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Roll call, Gina.
Mayor Pruitt. Mayor Pro Tem Hoskla.
Here.
Councilmember Cavallari.
Here.
Councilmember Todd. Councilmember Bond.
Here.
Councilmember Steckler.
Here.
Councilmember Vignell.
Here.
Mayor Pruitt and Councilmember Todd are at the AWC conference this week. Do I have a motion to excuse?
Motion to excuse.
Do I have a second?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Gina, did we have a list for audience? Anyone sign up for audience participation?
No one signed up.
No one signed up. So this is the public's opportunity to talk to the council on anything on the agenda or not on the agenda, to speak your mind. If anyone wants to speak, raise your hand. Hearing none, we'll move right along. Moving into... starting with presentations, City Manager.
Thank you, Mayor. We have a presentation from Sarah Sidman. She's a Vice President of the Arts Fund. Her discussion tonight, I've had the pleasure of speaking with her at length a couple of weeks ago. We're going to talk about the art of community building and the opportunities for us to leverage economic opportunities for the city through the arts. And there's also social benefits, but I understand the focus of the presentation is going to be to talk about how it can be an economic development vehicle, how it must possibly can bring more business down on our main street and into our community. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you for having me. And also please join me in welcoming my colleague, Katie Corella, the master of the clicker. I can only do so much multitasking. Arts Fund has been around for nearly 50 years, and we are deeply invested in the health of this region. We see firsthand the powerful impacts of our region's cultural nonprofits. As just referenced, for over 20 years, Arts Fund has produced economic impact studies. These are studies that track how the arts and cultural sector supports tens of thousands of jobs, attracts tourists who wouldn't otherwise come here, and generates $2 billion in business revenue. Our research tracks how the arts are a driver for economic activity, with patron spending rippling throughout the community. Strikingly, only one-third of patron expenditures are on ticket sales. The remaining two-thirds are spent on restaurants, transportation and parking, retail, hotels, and childcare. If I think back on my last cultural experience, my wallet can definitely attest to that data point. Significant and compelling, though these numbers are, and we do not undervalue the importance of driving the economy, they only tell part of the story. We knew arts have a much greater impact, a social impact, and so we set forth on a new research project, which is the first of its kind. To clarify, when I say arts, I'm talking about nonprofit organizations and all of their activities, programs, events, and classes. So by this, I mean dance, music and theater, visual art in galleries, heritage and folklore, open-air performances, youth festivals, the works. I'm really excited to be here tonight to brief you, the council, and you, the community, on the findings from Arts Fund's recent social impact of the arts study. Findings which illustrate the public value of the arts. Whether your focus is on strengthening the local economy, improving outcomes for youth, workforce development and talent retention, healthcare and mental health, or building stronger neighborhoods, this data will show how arts are a robust tool to help you meet these needs. When we first began our research, we found a surprising disconnect in how people in the community perceive the value of the arts. While 79% of people believe that arts benefit their personal well-being, and 60% of people cite the arts as a factor in their decision to live here, only 28% of people believe that arts promote social change at a community level. Only 28%. Let me rephrase that. We recognize the importance of arts, culture, and heritage in our own individual daily lives, and yet we often overlook the essential role arts play in our communities. So why do I call this a misperception? Because arts have social impact. Our study shows that the arts are a viable, powerful, and proven tool to affect positive social outcomes. Yet, as reinforced by the opinion poll, all too often arts are underutilized and unacknowledged as part of a community development strategy. I'm so grateful to be here today and hope that our conversation and all the ones that follow in this community can continue to change this public perception and make this more of a reality. We focused on three key impact areas where arts are intersecting with social issues and meeting community needs: youth development and education, health and wellness, and neighborhood vitality. Over the past 10 years, a significant body of research has emerged that connects art to positive social outcomes, and we reviewed over 150 of these national research resources. We also scanned 200 King County arts nonprofits and profiled 10 case studies. Our social impact study is among the first in the nation, and it is the very first in the Pacific Northwest to really take a look at arts' impact across social issues, and it offers us a good deal of new information to digest. So let's start with youth development and education, where our findings clearly show that involvement in the arts can improve academic and social outcomes for youth across socioeconomic status and across all ages. We see this in preschool youth, where at-risk students in arts-integrated preschools are better able to regulate their emotions than students in traditional preschools. And we see this in high schools, where students who take art in high school have higher SAT scores than those who don't. In fact, students with sustained arts access not only have higher GPAs and standardized test scores, but also lower dropout rates. Neurological research is showing us how arts strengthen the parts of the brain where executive function is developed, improving goal setting and follow-through abilities. And arts are also building critical thinking skills, creativity, and the capacity for self-expression. These are identified 21st century skills key to developing local talent and the future of work. Data shows that positive outcomes are especially strong for youth from low-income backgrounds. At-risk students involved in the arts are 23 percentage points more likely to attend college than their peers. 23%. Knowing low-income youth have the most to gain and yet all too often have the least exposure to arts programs, creating this access will help close the opportunity gap. And these benefits, too, ripple throughout the community. An example, Urban Artworks provides justice-involved youth on probation, job training, and life skills as they install murals throughout the region. These are kids trying to move out of the juvenile justice system, and art is providing an off-ramp from the school to prison pipeline. And a staggering data point, 83% of Urban Artworks youth don't reoffend. Not only are they out of the pipeline, they are out in the community giving back. Now to health and wellness. We find that both in and out of medical settings, arts can improve both individual and community health. In primary care and behavioral health, music and art therapy are widely recognized strategies to reduce stress and help individuals cope with trauma and symptoms of disease. In fact, nationwide, 45% of medical institutions offer some sort of arts program. That's nearly half the institutions in the country, with 80% stating that they do so to benefit patient recovery. Across any number of medical conditions, arts help lower anxiety, reduce dependence on medication, and in many cases, shorten hospital stays. And the economic impacts of that are obvious. Aging adults and those with diseases that cause dementia show particularly favorable health impacts. Among the many documented impacts, participating in arts reduces social isolation. For an aging person, social isolation has a negative health impact that's the equivalent to smoking 15 cigarettes a day. Arts can be a powerful antidote, leading to longer lives, better lived. Now to neighborhood vitality, which I'm particularly excited to talk about here tonight. When arts are present, there is a documented increase in neighborhood livability, community identity, and social well-being. These build community cohesion and help bridge cultural divides. Research ties arts participation to community empowerment and pride and to a shared sense of belonging. In fact, arts participants are more than twice as likely to volunteer in their communities. And cities with high concentrations of art not only have increased civic engagement and social cohesion, they track improved child welfare outcomes, along with reductions in crime and poverty. And the results are magnified in low-income neighborhoods. Public safety also comes into play here. Research shows that the presence of cultural space, be this a storefront or a performance venue, what have you, the presence of cultural space ties to a higher density of other walkable amenities. And linking back to economic development, the presence of cultural space is also linked to a higher occupancy income in contiguous spaces and overall increased asset valuation. To put that more in my language, the presence of arts and cultural spaces in neighborhoods correlates directly with a rise in foot traffic and property value. So what about business? Businesses also have a stake here. In interviews published by IBM, business leaders identified creativity as a highly valued core human skill that cannot be automated and is increasingly in high demand. Creative thinking is fundamental to our growing economy, and businesses benefit from an arts-educated pipeline of workers. And not only do the arts prepare the workforce of tomorrow, they build communities workers want to live in today. From a competitive perspective, data shows that places that invest in and promote arts thinking through their education and workforce systems and that host a range of arts amenities have a distinct advantage in the future economy. It's important to acknowledge and understand that arts aren't working in isolation. In King County, which is where we sampled, 84% of arts nonprofits report partnership outside the sector. That's more than 4 out of 5 arts organizations working together with schools, with refugee and immigrant organizations, hospitals and clinics, senior centers, city departments, environmental organizations, and so many more. We uncovered local examples of substance use disorder treatment centers partnering with improv companies, hospitals bringing arts into patient bedsides, and others incorporating the arts into physician training, and homelessness social service agencies wrapping arts throughout their programming because the arts provide their clients with community connections that strengthen their abilities to stay housed. The results are clear. When art is integrated with another intervention and in complement to traditional approaches to social issues, it makes people more successful. We are talking about new possibility here and an aspect of solving community challenges that isn't currently acknowledged. The public value of the arts. We're talking about how arts can be a proactive, strategic investment in community. If there's one thing I hope you all take away today, it's that arts are not a charity. They are a strategy. A strategy that advances both economic and community growth. So what can you do? As the data suggests, both investing in the arts and supporting policy promoting arts access and affordability have positive outcomes that ripple throughout a community. This can mean providing funding directly to arts providers and supporting arts programming. It can mean incentivizing others to do so. It can mean investing in new cultural spaces and the preservation of existing ones. And it could mean advancing policy aligned with these goals. Geographic expansion is one specific way in which we can drive equitable outcomes, as is expanding arts access to vulnerable populations. Another key way in which you can take action is to invite arts voices and arts-based strategies to the planning tables that are shaping the region's growth. When you sit down at a policy planning table, and this applies to all of us, when we sit down to shape the future, be it examining expanded public health coverage or mental health coverage, real estate development, education programs, public outreach, think about including a voice from the cultural sector at the outset and design programs and creative solutions incorporating the powerful contributions arts can offer. How we experience art is personal, but it doesn't stop there. Arts have significant economic and social impact. And as we look to the future, we will need to find a way to leverage and expand these powerful impacts so more people and more communities can benefit. Thank you for the honor and the opportunity to be here to talk with you tonight and to meet with all of you, to brief you on the findings for the research. I really look forward to your questions and comments. And also, Gina wisely advised us to bring along some additional information, so we have some collateral with a lot of the statistics we shared over there by the door. Thank you.
Councilmember Cavallari.
Thank you, Councilmember Holzclaw. Thanks for the presentation. Fantastic job. I think a re-education, if you will, of the existing arts programs and the future arts programs within our communities is what makes a city like ours so vibrant. As the city's liaison for the Parks Board, for instance, we're constantly doing, whether it's the arts walk, whether it's outreach with the school district and whatnot, it's essential that these programs stay alive in our community, so I applaud what you're doing. So I do have some questions because I'm always a little dazed that one of the reasons with the numbers so telling that you were showing us earlier as far as juvenile recidivism and whatnot, if they're that good, why are the schools in large numbers canceling so many programs and so much funding?
It is too snarky to turn that question right back to
See, but I think it's important that you say, you tell it like it is, because these are the voters, these are the ones that pass the levies for the school and pay the taxes. So it's
no, I think that the the public opinion poll was one of the most surprising things to me in this process. We worked for over 2 years on this study. Relatively early on, we got that information, and it, to some degree, it underscores why so often arts are seen as inessential, a nice to have, but the first on the chopping block when something has to go. What this study and what we're trying to share with the data, what it shows is how arts are really essential. They are a complementary part of the solution, not a competing priority. As a mother of a relatively young, I have a just under 2-year-old, and when I think about it, if I had to pit some choices about her education or arts programming, and I was looking at them as an either-or, I'd be torn. But they are not an either-or. They are an and with additional opportunities. And so I think that is part of the perception shift that we can all work towards. I also think that there's something, a big surprising takeaway for me had to do with the partnerships, the 84% of organizations reporting partnership. And as we're talking about that in communities and hearing more, I'm very curious, I see Uniform over here, hearing more from those who are outside the sector talking about the powerful benefits that partnering with the arts can bring. It's those kinds of stories that we really need to hear more of to understand how arts have this value.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you very much. That was phenomenal information. I'm also, thank you, I don't know where you found that old picture of me when I used to play the violin about 20 years ago, but I'm just shocked. I haven't seen it in years.
That guy's skinny.
I was thin back then. This comes from, I work on this. We're going to go into some planning meetings, and we're going to be thinking about the future of our city. And this kind of information, along with other opportunities that we're looking at, you've kind of given us a good template of what to look at on everything that we consider for the future of Mill Creek, whether it be from the social impact of it and also the economic impact. We have to look at both. And this was a great template of being able to look at both of them and weigh both of them. I think I cannot thank you enough for taking your time to come up here to Mill Creek from Seattle. You had to pay for child care, I know, and to do this, and we really sincerely, sincerely appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Can I ask you one more question?
Absolutely.
Sorry. Just so I know, because I didn't see those numbers up there, what is the biggest source of revenue? Is it from the philanthropic side? Is that where the major source of funding comes for most of this?
For arts from the nonprofit sector, no. I'm more well-versed now in the social impact than the economic impact, but I'd say that there's a balance of earned and contributed revenue. So ticket sales, sponsorships, things like that would be counting towards the earned. And then the the ticket sales, as I mentioned in this, are only one-third. Well, sorry. Ticket sales for an arts organization tend to make up less than 50% of their overall income. So they're one-third of patron expenditures and less than half of what arts organizations have. So it really is a delicate balance of earned and contributed income. And one of the challenges that we face, I am not speaking for your community at large, but which we face as a whole in the sector, is both inconsistencies in corporate funding, as corporations shift their priorities. Sometimes very significant investments in arts and culture get shifted in a different direction. That's challenging for the sector to respond to. Likewise, there some public funders are not as sustainable and shift as we've seen on a federal level. The competition or the ways in which arts as a funding priority for public funding is also called into jeopardy. But no, I'd say it's a balance of earned and contributed. It's definitely not driven by one sector or another.
Can I ask two questions? You cite a lot of statistics about the importance of arts arising from the presence of art. What do you mean by that? What's the scope and context of the presence that generated those statistics? And then the second question is, you talked about the study, but I'm not sure I got a clear understanding of what the Arts Fund is and what it is that you guys do. If you could talk about that for just a couple
minutes.
Sure,
thank you. When I talk about the presence, I think I most reference that regarding the neighborhood vitality. So that has to do with the existence of places and spaces where art takes place. So like a gallery and a theater and a performance space in a park, those kinds of things. When I was talking more about the youth and things like that, that had to do more with participating in the arts. And so taking a class or having them come into your school or going to a show, those kinds of things. So the data that we sampled, and like I mentioned, we reviewed over 150 different national research resources. So some of those are longitudinal studies tracking school-aged children from K through 12 in a particular area. Others of those are looking at three or four different urban locations and tracking how cultural space leads to these public safety benefits. So you're right in highlighting that the language is a little soft around that, because across the different areas, we're talking about different types of activities. And in terms of what Arts Fund does, at the core of Arts Fund's mission is the belief that arts strengthen community. So we are a fundraiser and a grant maker. Our mission is to strengthen the community by supporting the arts through leadership, advocacy, and grant making. Next year, we're celebrating 50 years of being in this community. We primarily serve King and Pierce counties through our grant making, but we've also granted up in Snohomish County, and our research encompasses also Kitsap County.
Any other questions? Well, thank you again for coming. That was very educational, helpful. Appreciate it.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to keep talking about the arts, but now we get to talk about general obligation tax bonds.
Can I make a suggestion? If any of the audience would prefer not to stay for the tax, and some of you might have come for the arts, feel free to leave. It's okay. We won't be offended. Yeah.
I thought they were all here for the FAA.
I'm shocked at the mass exodus.
Yeah, I'm shocked too. Dan, you don't get to leave. Dan, get back here.
So glad you got the position.
Well, thank you.
You do.
Carmen stays.
It's okay. We can't leave. We understand. Actually, we're going to talk about bonds. We find it interesting.
Is that it?
Thank you, Mayor. First, I want to note that our finance director, Peggy Lauerman, is unable to be here tonight. Gina and I will be co-presenting on this, and hopefully we'll be able to answer all the questions. Just by way of review, on June 11th, Council approved Ordinance 2019-851, authorizing limited tax general obligation bonds in the amount of $3,322,000. However, Council also directed us to provide additional analysis regarding what might be the optimal level of financing. The direction at the time was to consider it at the original $2.8 million and then the additional $500,000 beyond that. What we have done this evening is not only provided that, but in the spirit of informing Council of their full options, we provided an intermediate range as well at the $250,000 mark. So you'll see as we go through our presentation that there's additional analysis that incorporates what it would look like to borrow somewhere in the intermediate range as well. So, Gina, you want to get us started? And then Gina and I are going to work together to co-present.
Okay. Thank you, Michael. Good evening, Council. So tonight's presentation is a follow-up to the discussion that we had at the last Council meeting on June 11th. And tonight's presentation will have a review of some of the topics that were discussed on June 11th, so including the F failure costs and the cost increase and the debt. We're going to talk a little bit about the potential use of the additional proceeds. So if we borrow, whether it's $500K or $250K, how would those dollars be used? There'll be some tables with rate analysis. We'll talk about a performance plan and council repayment evaluation. Essentially, what that means is what are the touch points at which staff will come to council to discuss the surface water agent infrastructure program, and how will that performance be measured against the plan that we had. Very similar to the exercise that we had last week where we talked about the plan and then the execution, and we talked about a delta of $250,000 and how we close that gap. That's what that bullet refers to.
Before then, I'm sorry, go ahead. Let me know before you move on to the next slide.
And then last but not least, we'll talk about the cost benefits. So why go through this exercise? What are the benefits?
So what I've learned in a very short amount of time is that there's no shortage of use for these additional funds. Having said that, you'll see where we are reaching certain milestones in the future that we want to check in with Council to ensure that we're all on the same page in terms of whether we want to go forward or whether we want to exercise our option in the agreement. I think it's called the call option, to be able to repay whatever proceeds we've been loaned ahead of time. As I've worked more with Gina and her team, what I've learned is that not only are there additional pipes to be scoped, but even the footage that we already have obtained needs to still be interpreted. So we only know what we know up to this point, but there is a safe bet that we can continue to use these funds. Having said that, we want to have an opportunity to touch in with Council at various intervals to ensure that what we would recommend, it matches with the Council's intention with regards to the funding. So that's one of the overarching tenors of our presentation tonight.
Okay. So a couple slides here. This slide and the next one are going to be a review of what was presented at the June 11th Council meeting. So this table one comes from our last Council meeting, in which I was coming to Council recommending the award to Blue Line for construction inspection. So that's shown as item two here on table one. And I was showing the total construction phase cost estimate with a contingency, total cost a little bit over $1 million. And then doing a compare and contrast essentially with what was budgeted when we came up with a surface water utility rate. And at that time, our planning numbers had us at a little bit over $900,000 of expenditures in 2019. And so these numbers here, again, this is all a review from the June 11th Council meeting, just showed a gap between what was planned and then now, as we're executing what we know, and the delta being $250,000, and we talked about how to close that gap and looking at possibly tapping into reserves in 2024 as an option, meaning not having the $500,000 reserve that's our target, but tapping into that. And then at the last council meeting, we also talked about two options, the $2.8 million bond being the base, and that's what was computed in to the surface water utility fee. And then we talked about possibly borrowing an additional $500,000 and bringing up the total bond amount to $3.3 million. So, again, this is all reviewed from the June 11th council meeting. And then additional information, I believe it was discussed at the June 11th, but potential uses. So why borrow additional funds over the $2.8 million? So part of it is, and probably the most important one, is to be able to assess the small pipes. Right now, we do not have funds directly allocated to the assessment of the small pipes. Also, the construction market, there has been a spike in construction costs for the past 2 years. And we did look back at Engineering News Record, ENR, which is a common resource for looking at trends. And the Seattle market over the past 2 years has had an upward trend. Also looked at WashDOT bids received. And depending on the time of the year, when they've advertised project, they have had a similar pattern to what we've had, which is higher bids. And then also there's an inherent risk of pipe failure when we're dealing with old pipes. So I'll share a little bit about our experience with Sweetwater Ranch, in which in December of 2017, we were called for a sinkhole. And as we started digging for the sinkhole, we ended up chasing this pipe all the way north from Sweetwater Ranch to Douglas Fir. And part of it is it's an old pipe we were working on. And as we started putting and placing construction equipment, the pipe started failing. This is, I'm hopeful that this won't happen, but it could happen. It is a possibility. It happened with Sweetwater Ranch. And so those would be some of the potential uses for the additional proceeds, meaning the additional bond above and beyond the $2.8 million.
Yeah. I want to add that as we all know, when we do these on an emergency basis, we're paying a multiple of sometimes between 3 and 5 times what we would if we do this in a way that's anticipated, modulated, and bid out ahead of time. So to the extent our additional diligence may reveal areas that are at risk further, I understand we've addressed the largest of the pipes, but that doesn't mean a sea failure couldn't cause havoc as well, especially if it's been scouring for a number of years before we finally address it. And so this is where the scenario is that we built out the two for the analysis, but also for the council as an additional measure. We did something on an intermediate basis at the $250,000 level.
So that's a new scenario that we're presenting tonight that was not considered at the last council meeting. And these tables here have a lot of information, so I'll go through them slowly. The top table here refers to the rates, and the $2.8 million, which is the base, those are the yearly surface water utility fees that were approved by council in 2018. And they started this year with $150 per year, and they increase to $175 next year, $200, and then a 3% increase over the next few years through 2026. So all that is familiar information, and again, approved by resolution. The other two scenarios here are the $250,000 additional bond and then the $250,000 additional bond. And I will highlight and shed light specifically on the yellow numbers here shaded in this table, because this is something that we didn't deliberately discuss or discuss in full at the last council meeting. And the additional bonds, whether they're $250,000 or $500,000, do have an impact on the yearly surface water fee. And the impacts don't materialize until 2022, but there is an increase. So this top table shows the nominal increase, and then the second table is the difference. And so if you look at the 2.8 million at 2022, the surface water fee would be 206. That's if we just borrow what we originally plan on borrowing, which was 2.8 mil. And if we were to increase that bond to $250K, that rate would go up by $8. And if we were to increase that bond by an additional $500K, that difference in 2022 would be $12, which is 218 minus the 206. That's what the 12 is. And so this is carried on over the next few years. So that's what this table represents. You know, and then the bottom portion is just percentages.
How would we be funding the sea failures in a couple of years? Would we be running another bond, looking at another bond once we get through the design and assessing the scope of the sea failures?
So we'll talk about that. There's the slide, the performance plan slide. It depends on how those sea failures, specifically how the contract bids come in. And so if they're within the planned dollar amounts, then...
Planned dollar amounts of this bond?
The planned dollar amounts planned in this table right here. The budgeted dollar amounts.
Okay. So we're anticipating that those sea failures would at least partially be addressed through this bond. What I was trying to get at is, are we looking at another bond for other improvements? Because we're looking at the rate increase potentially if we go with a higher amount of the bond. But I was wondering if we are looking at if we are facing a separate bond to fund separate improvements, we'd be also looking at increase just to a different bond if we didn't increase this one. Are you following me?
With a higher interest rate.
Well, right, aside from the interest rate. But if we ran another bond, you highlight in isolation, all I'm trying to point out is we highlight in isolation that if we went with a higher amount, it would have an impact on the bond. And all I'm raising is if we did another bond for other failures, if this bond wasn't enough, that rate's going to go up one way or the other.
I would assume yes.
Yeah, so yeah. That I just want to keep that in mind. It's they could be going up regardless of what we do today with this bond for the improvements that we have in front of us.
I had a question.
Yes.
So this is interesting. So you're saying, if I'm reading this right, if we go with a higher amount of 250 or 500, we're really not going to be paying for that until 2022, correct?
Correct. Our residents won't see the impact of that until 2022.
So, but we're going to know well in advance of that what level of sea failures we have, like in 2020, correct?
That is correct.
So by going with the higher amount, in the short term, it's not going to cost us any more, our residents. But it does get the money at a lower rate. And if we find out that we don't need it, we can pay it back with no prepayment penalty whatsoever. Correct?
There's some interest amounts, and we'll talk about that in a
whatever
few slides.
Whatever we hold on to for interest, mm-hmm. But there's no penalties, no hidden fees or anything like that. Just interest for the time we held their money.
Michael?
Yeah, I would answer the same question. There's analysis that shows what it's going to cost us to borrow the money. If we pay it back to the extent we have additional interest that has not yet been paid, that's where the savings would be achieved. I do not believe with our call option, as I've understood it explained to us, that there's any penalty.
Right.
We get to pay it back early if we so choose. And we have milestones built in where we actually have the conversation with council and we either receive your approval to do so or we continue on our way. So there's going to be an opportunity here for us to all have multiple check-ins, and we've got a Gantt chart that can show that.
The part I'm seeing here is that we've got a chance at some really good rate on money.
Yes.
That we can borrow now, that it's going to cost us some interest.
Yeah.
If we hold on to it for any period of time, a year through 2020, we're going to pay some interest for it. But we're going to know how much more we need by next year, and then we can decide at that point if we want to pay it back or keep the money, because it's probably going to cost more. I've never seen it this low. This is pretty remarkable for a bond. It's a really good deal. So that's something for us to consider. It might cost us a little bit, but even that little bit that's going to cost us to 2020 in the equivalent of what more money would cost from an interest rate, I think is going to be much less. So the interest alone, I would assume we'd look at that and
yes,
actually tabulate it.
Yes, and we have some information on that.
I'll shut up.
Okay. So now going back to those touch points where we will know more information, this table on the top is the same table from the previous slide. So it's just the yearly surface water utility rates and then highlighting where the increase would be in 2022, depending on the amounts that are borrowed. And then the table in the bottom, that's a public works performance plan. And these are the touch points where the minimum touch points where we would come to council. And so there's six of them. Opportunities for doing again what we did last week, this compare and contrast. We had a plan slash budget, and then we're executing. How do the two compare? So there's six opportunities that are ahead of us where we can do that compare and contrast and see whether we need to really tap into the additional bond amounts. So the first opportunity that council will be coming back to council will be with the C failures design. I'm calling that bundle one because there's multiple C failures, and that's happening in July, so just a few weeks out. That design will carry on through the end of 2019. The next opportunities will be F failures construction, and that project's actually going to start construction fairly soon. We already came to council. Council awarded that contract, but construction is happening in the second half of 2019. And as with most construction, there will be change orders, and there will be things that we at this time cannot predict. And once construction's done, then we will know how much did the construction of the F failures really cost the city of Mill Creek. Depending on the change order amounts and the thresholds based on our procurement procedures, we may need to or not need to come to council. But those are potential touch points. So that gets us through the end of 2019. And then once we have that information, then we'll know if we can actually want to and can afford to proceed with the small pipes assessment. My estimate of how much that assessment would cost is roughly $300,000. Again, please don't hold me to that. That's a lot of pipes that we need to review. And from a staffing perspective, bandwidth perspective, and also from a funding perspective, we're looking at possibly starting that small pipe assessment in 2020. Concurrently, starting in 2020, that's when we would be advertising. So we complete the design. Item one is the design of the C failures. Completing it by the end of the year, then advertising it towards the end of the year, opening bids in 2020, and then construction through the third quarter of 2020. So at this point, in this Gantt chart in 2020, we would have information about two of our construction projects. The F failures, and then the first bundle of C failures. Right there in 2020, in the second half of the year, we would start with the second bundle of C failures, and that's approximately 6 month duration. And doing the same thing that I just explained with the bundle one, the first bundle. For the C failures, we would be completing the design in 2020, and then advertising, opening bids in 2021, and going through construction through the summer and early fall of 2021. So all these are touch points that would happen within this time frame showing on the table where our rates could still hold the same. Again, if council chooses to increase the bond amount by 250K or 500K, the impact of that choice will not be felt and activated until 2022, and we would have all these opportunities to see, again, where that plan versus execution, the compare and contrast, where we are.
On line four, that covers both the bid opening and construction. It looks like it covers three-quarters of the year. Is it fair to assume that the bid opening and knowing what the costs are going to be is probably going to be by the end of the first quarter?
Yes. So for item four, the idea is that we would have completed the design by December of 2019, so that's by the end of this year, and then we would be opening bids in January of 2020, and then construction would start probably in the spring and then go on for several months. So we would have that information. We would know what the bids are in early 2020.
And we'd have the funds in hand if we went with a higher amount to start that.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Michael, do you have anything else to add to this?
No, I mean, that's really the point. We'd not only have the funds in hand, but we'd have the funds in the hand at this rate, this favorable rate.
So cost-benefit analysis, so this gets to what is, how much does it cost the city to have this opportunity to increase the bond amount at a good rate, and there is a cost, and that cost is captured in this table, which are the interest costs. And they're tabulated for the $250K option, the $500K option, and over the next few years. The benefits, of course, would be the assessment of the small pipes, so having that knowledge as to what the condition of the small pipes, what the condition is. It provides additional liquidity for cost overruns, and particularly, again, we're talking about two construction contracts, the F failures and the first bundle of C failures, and knowing if there's change orders or if bids come in high. It reduces the likelihood of a draw from the reserves, and it capitalizes on the low interest rate.
That's an annual interest expense?
The 2.44%?
No, the numbers up above.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, those are per year, total per year.
Why is it 1%?
Michael, do you have?
I'm sorry,
why
didn't hear the question.
1%?
Why is it 1% listed as the interest cost?
I'm not certain, and I'm sorry I can't answer that question.
Underneath the heading, it says
yeah.
Interest cost 1%, yeah. So I think that's where
yeah.
we're
going. I see it, but the question is, why is that different than the 2.55?
Right.
Yeah.
I guess I would have thought that it would be 2.44%. So
at this moment, I'm going to presume that was a typo, and we want to apologize for that.
Okay. I think I recall that there was a graduated interest, as I recall from the last presentation, but I may be wrong, and I don't have it here in my notes. So
yeah.
That's something we can go check again.
We can look into it.
And I'm sorry we don't have that. That was an oversight on my part.
Yeah, I'm just confused by those interest numbers because I thought when we had this discussion last week, and I forget the gentleman's name, was it Meyer? The gentleman making the bond presentation, I thought he said that our annual bond payment at the original amount would have been $235,000 a year, and if we increased it by $500,000, he did a back of the napkin calculation and thought that annual payment would be $260,000. So I'm trying to figure out how the interest on $500,000 in a year is only an additional $2,500.
Yeah. I don't want to speak to the calculation because, frankly, neither of us computed that. And I'm sorry that we're not able to give you that additional information. If that's a reason for council to hold off on action, I'm not sure that we have the option to do that, but I just simply apologize in advance. I can't speak to the computation.
Yeah, we're at our deadline, so.
Yeah, it's pretty time sensitive, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
It is, so.
Well, it's just a matter of quantifying so we all understand what the interest carry is. And I thought it was about $25,000 a year. And so how much of that interest we'd actually incur depends on. That's why we asked the staff to include the jump-off point so we could know how soon we could be able to make that decision on do we return the money or are we going to have a use for it. And it sounds like we should have that within 9 months, if not sooner. I mean, we'll be into the F failure construction and know if there's any cost overruns. Hopefully not, but if there are, we'll know sooner rather than later, and we'll know first part of 2020, hopefully, what the C failures are going to cost us initially to get
Correct.
That started.
Correct. That's that table right there.
Okay. Is there any chance we could reach out to Peggy? Is there any way to reach out to her during the meeting that she might be able to answer that question?
I doubt it.
Okay. Okay.
I can try, but.
Yeah, we do need to make a decision tonight, and I agree with everybody else up here. I don't believe that number. It's a great deal.
We'll give it a shot, Councilman Stuckler.
Yeah. Would you call me? No, okay.
Yeah, well. Any other questions?
I'm going to get on board and support this. I said it last week. Our consultant absolutely sold me in the ability to get money pretty cheaply and be able to use it in the short term here. One of the things that struck me last week and the week before, as we've been going through this process, is the lack of bidders for these projects. And I believe they called it risky.
Correct.
Why the bids are high. So I anticipate higher costs at this point, and that's, I mean, I don't like to get on board with just borrowing more money to have it in the bank, but it seems like it's going to be abundantly necessary. Thank you.
Any other comments, questions, discussion, motion?
Could we try to reach out to Peggy before we take the vote, just so we know what we're voting on?
We've just emailed her.
Just emailed her. Could we come back to this before we take a vote on it? Give it half an hour to go through some of their items. It'd just be nice to know we tried.
Yeah.
And then if we can't, we take the vote. I'm not disagreeing at all with Councilman Cavallari.
Yep.
I mean, this is good money, but we just should have the number if we can.
Well, if it pleases the council, we can.
We can do that. We can just move on to the two items of new business and see if we get a response by the end of that. And
thank
if
you.
Not, we can decide what to do then.
Fair enough.
I have a recommendation. Could we reach out to the gentleman who we're getting the bond from? Maybe he has the data?
We can try that as well.
The interest rate was fixed. The number I remember was our annual payment would be $235, and he did a back of the napkin calculation. He said he thought it'd be roughly $260 if we went up by another $500,000.
That would make sense.
That'd be the annual cost. I'm just not sure that interest rate is correct.
His most up-to-date information gave it an all-in true interest cost of 2.56%, and you're right. It's $223,499 a year.
What was the original amount we were looking at?
$3,000.
That's with the $3,350,000.
The principal amount of the bonds. Is it 2880?
2822.
I'm sorry, what was it?
$2,822,000.
Yeah, they had $68,000 of interest on that amount just in 1 year.
On the 500?
No, on the
250?
3 million.
The 2,882,000.
Oh, I'm sorry, but the additional cost.
No, I'm just calculating what the annual payments we would make are principal and interest. So just the original bond amount in the first year at 2.44% interest would be about $68,000 of interest in that first year.
Okay, so there's no prepayment of the interest. It's principal and interest right from the beginning?
That's my understanding, but I don't know.
It's usually you get the interest up front, and then principal factors come in later.
That's my understanding as well, that it's both from the beginning.
It's both principal and interest.
That's my understanding.
Okay.
Well, let's reach out. Let's move on to the two items of new business and see if we can get responses to those questions before we bring this back up.
Thank you. And we apologize for not having that information.
So with that, let's move on to item D under new business, the appointment to the Park and Recreation Board. The interview committee was Councilmember Cavallari and Councilmember Vignal. I'll leave it to one of you.
I will defer to Councilmember Vignal to make the recommendation.
Yes, the committee met, and as we often discuss, we have a wonderful problem, if you will, here in Mill Creek, that we have so many qualified applicants that are so excited to volunteer, and that's what makes us great. So at this moment, I would like to make a motion to appoint Ryan Nichols to serve a midterm appointment on the Park and Recreation Board, expiring October 31st, 2020.
Second that motion.
Any further discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none. The motion carries. Thank you. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Now on to server update. City manager.
Yeah. Thank you, Mayor. Actually, James and I have worked even more on this since the original presentation materials were put together. An opportunity to meet with a local member of our community who had a lot of interest in talking about what our proposal was from his level of expertise. I met with this individual both yesterday evening, and then we also had a telephone conference with him today. So what you're going to see is slightly different from what was in your materials, but it reflects our best work to date. And furthermore, what we're asking for council to consider is treating this as a study session. We're not going to ask for a vote or an action item this evening's session. It'll give us all an opportunity to digest this while James and I continue to refine whatever information may come out of the queries from this evening and anything else that may develop between now and the next meeting. But we fully expect at the next meeting to ask for council's support on going forward. So with that, I would ask Mr. Bush, you get us started.
Right. Thank you, Michael. Good evening, Council. So this presentation is to discuss some needed upgrades to the city's server systems. And so this is the agenda that I have. So I'd like to discuss what our existing server infrastructure looks like, the reasons why we're due for an upgrade, the options that we have before us to upgrade, and what I believe the best solution is for us. So what we have currently here at the city are two different servers. One of them was purchased back in 2014, which has a warranty that's coming up for expiration later this year. And we have a second server that was purchased back in 2017, and it has a warranty that's coming up for expiration in 2022. And so what we run here at the server is these two physical servers, and we utilize a virtualization technology that allows us to run multiple virtual servers on these two physical servers. It's a pretty common technology that allows for cost savings and some redundancy and benefits of that nature to migrate the servers between the two if there's issues and that sort of thing. There's some servers listed here that we might be able to decommission in the future once we migrate those services to other locations, such as the police records database that you see listed there under physical server 2. That's an older server that we're looking to get those records migrated off to the services that are with Snow 911 now. And then we're looking to upgrade the permitting server as well. That might be an opportunity that we can move that off to the cloud. And so we're always looking for opportunities to reduce the footprint of our server infrastructure, to minimize the costs associated with it, and look for opportunities where things can be moved into cloud services to reduce the costs that we have to run on servers here as well. So this is our physical server infrastructure that we run here. And then next I want to show you what we have running in the cloud currently. So these are what is commonly called SaaS, or software as a service. And so this is the list of items that we're currently running in the cloud. So iCompass, this is what we use for our council agenda packet creation, where the meeting minutes are put together, and then it's pushed down to the iPad app for those of you that have an iPad. We utilize software called GovQA. This is where our citizens and other people that visit the city can come in into our website and report issues that they have. If they see a stop sign down or a street light out or a problem with the sidewalk or vegetation overgrowth or a code compliance issue, they go through this system to report that issue, and it comes in and gets routed to the appropriate person to respond back to them. That's hosted in the cloud. This is the same system that we use to track public records requests, respond to those requests, upload whatever records they're seeking, and send those back to them. So that's also up in the cloud. We use a system called Page Freezer to archive our social media and website and text messaging the public records requests as well. It combines all that into one place, and so we can easily respond to that. Code publishing, we put online. Springbrook is our finance package is online. ADP is our payroll processing. HR management and recruiting is online. Office 365, as you know, is our email that we recently moved online. That's a big one to have online. New World. We use that for police dispatch and records management. We go through Snow 911. That's sort of a private cloud that we use for that. So the list goes on. You can see we have a lot of services that we have online. So we've looked for where it was a good fit. We've moved that service to the cloud instead of running it in-house. Many of these services are cloud only, but many of these we could run internally, such as the city's website. There's many cities that run a web server internally, and they choose to do it that way. But it's a lot easier to it's less to manage being a smaller city and a smaller IT shop to just let that be done by an outside service, and it's more cost effective and just less overhead to do. So now I come to reasons for upgrading. So our current server infrastructure is the two physical servers that you saw on the earlier slide. And they were kind of put together out of necessity, but not really done out of planning. One of the servers, the first one purchased in 2014, that was originally purchased for another reason. And then when that purpose was no longer needed, I repurposed it to be a virtual server. And then the second server was purchased to kind of help complement that one. And I kind of made do with what I had at the time and what the budget allowed. But it wasn't really made to do what it's being used for, neither one of those. And so we're using a free version of virtualization software, which, again, was done at the time with the funds that we had for cost savings. But neither one of those virtual servers talk to each other. They don't know anything about each other. They're just kind of in their own little silo. And so if either one of those servers were to have a major hardware problem and were to shut down, all those servers running on it would go down. So if I could hop back real quick, you'll see the server on the right there, physical server 2. If it had a major hardware problem and it were to go down, all six of those servers on it would go down, and they would be offline for an extended period of time while we found a replacement server. The server on the left does not have the capacity to take over all those servers that are running on the second one, and vice versa. They just weren't made for that high availability. So that's kind of point number one. We have minimal fault tolerance, and there's no automated failover capability. So we're at a high risk for an extended outage, and I think being a government agency, we need to step up our game and have an improved customer service. So we need to have some better redundancy in our systems. So now is a good time to upgrade. We have one of the servers that's reaching end of life. It's reaching end of warranty. 5 years is a pretty standard life for a server, and so it's due for replacement. So now is a good time. Instead of putting money towards another server that's not really meant for this fault tolerance, let's put that money towards a system that is meant for fault tolerance. Another reason for upgrading is the expanding needs of the city. You just finished with the presentation from Gina about the surface water repairs that are going on. The amount of data that they collect while they're doing the CCTV video inspections through those pipes is enormous. They basically run a video camera through the pipe and they do a recording, and that data has to go somewhere. The amount of data it collects is huge, and it takes up a lot of storage on the servers, and we need to put it there where she did some calculations for me on the cost of that is in the hundreds of thousands of dollars to collect that data. And if we don't put that data somewhere where it's protected and backed up, and then we lose it, I mean, that cost that's lost to gather that data is more than just the data itself. It's that cost that it took to collect that data to have to go and do that over again. Police digital evidence is growing enormously. It used to be they'd take a couple photos of something, a crime scene or whatever, and we'd put those in the digital evidence software, and we were done with it. Now the officers are coming in with DVR footage from a robbery or somebody steals something out of a store, and they have these 4K cameras in the stores, and they have these gigabytes and gigabytes of video footage that they want to turn in for evidence, and we need somewhere to put that securely. The police department also recently purchased their Faro crime scene scanner, where they put it up in the middle of the crime scene, and it takes a zillion pictures, and it takes data points to recreate the crime scene. And they did it at the recent shooting at the Safeway Albertsons, and that collected an enormous amount of data, and I'll show you a kind of a pie chart to get an idea of how much data that one crime collected compared to how much data we have available on the police server. It's just an enormous amount of data that one case collected. And then, so that's just our current things that are happening now. And then we talk about future needs. So the city doesn't really have a GIS department. We have one person that does it about 10 to 20% of their time. I see this as an up-and-coming future need for the city. And the amount of data that GIS with these large maps and data sets, that's also a large need that I could see coming up in the future. We've talked a lot about contract management and document management and digitizing more and more of the city records. That's also another need that's coming up. So this is the data. In red there is just numbers to help see the data size. So 32 gigabytes is the number is what that one case took for the police evidence, and 323 gigabytes is what we have left on the police server. So it's a pretty big chunk out of what's left for the entire police department. So it's just to give you an idea of what one case. I mean, if we got a few more of those cases, it would fill it up, and we'd have to look on how to expand the storage on the police server pretty quickly. On the GIS, I would, if you have some time, you might want to check out what Kirkland and Edmonds are doing with GIS. They have some GIS websites, maps.kirklandwa.gov and maps.edmondswa.gov. They're doing some pretty amazing things with their GIS and their mapping. You can go online, see that they have CIP projects that their citizens can go and look at, and a lot of other pretty cool things that they're doing. So what are some options, and what's the budget that we had set aside for something like this? So there's kind of two things that I looked at to move forward with. One is called the hyperconverged infrastructure, which is also commonly called HCI. Another option would be to take the city servers and move them to the cloud. That's a popular thing that a lot of businesses are doing is take your servers, move them to the cloud. Don't run that locally anymore. The budget that we looked at doing the server upgrade was $60,000 based on research I had done back in the budgeting time last summer. So that's kind of the options moving forward. So let me explain hyperconverge real quick just so you kind of understand how it works. Previously, with virtualization, you kind of had three separate things. You had your servers that kind of did all your computing, you had your networking that connected everything, and then you had your storage where all the data was stored. And sometimes these were three different vendors. You had your hard drive people, you had your server people, and you had your networking people. It worked, but sometimes when you had problems, your server guys would say, well, it's your hard drive people's fault. That's why it's not working right, and vice versa. Everybody was pointing fingers as who was the problem. And sometimes this cost a lot of money because there were three separate systems you had to maintain, three separate service agreements you had to maintain, so it could be very expensive. So in the last few years, they've come up with hyperconverge. So converge brings everything together. It's all in one system. They bring the networking, the servers, and the storage all into one vendor, one system, one hardware chassis. And it's kind of the term that some people like to call is one throat to choke. So if you have a problem, you call one vendor, and it makes the technology work a lot more seamlessly because it's all made by one vendor, and so they know how it all works together. So that's kind of where the hyperconverged terminology comes from. So to start, I looked at three different hyperconverged technologies, different companies. One is Nutanix. Another one is from a company called Scale Computing. And another one was by Dell. They brand theirs as VxRail. And there's three different hardware costs there. And one other thing that I wanted to include in the cost there is if we continue to run the servers here, then we need to back them up here as well. So there's a backup system that we currently use, and we would need to continue to maintain that. And so the second bullet point under each of those is kind of the total cost that goes with it, because it's not just the servers, it's also the backup that goes along with it. And so the cost for the system is the first line there, but it's a better picture to see what the total cost would be, because it goes along with it. You have to back it up as it if you continue to run the servers here. So I also looked at the cloud, and so I reached out to our one of our vendors that we get our Microsoft licensing from, and I asked them to look at our current server infrastructure and what it would cost if we were to take our servers and put them in the cloud. And I looked at the Microsoft Azure cloud, their government cloud. They have a public cloud, and then they have a government cloud that's meant specifically for government customers. It meets like FIPS compliance and CJIS, that's the Criminal Justice Information Systems requirements. So they have a specific government cloud for government customers, and this is the government pricing. And so I got three-year cost estimates. There's some other considerations when you go into the cloud. So if all your servers are in the cloud, you need to make sure that you have a good connection to those in the cloud. If your internet goes down, then you've lost your connection to all your services in the cloud. It's not down the hall to your server room that you need to worry about. It's all the way to, in this case, Arizona that you need to worry about. And so Microsoft offers what they call an express route connection, or you can use your existing internet connection to connect to the services in the cloud. So we have a pretty good internet connection now, but most recommend that you get a redundant internet connection, so if one goes down, you don't lose all your connections. So this is the cost for a redundant internet connection, three-year cost. And then once your data is your services are in the Microsoft cloud, while their systems are very, very highly available and they guarantee some really good uptimes, they still do not guarantee your data. They still recommend that you back up your data. And they don't recommend that you back it up locally and bring your data back down, because they charge you based on how much transfer you do. If you pull your data back down, they charge you for downloading your data back down. So they recommend that you use the Microsoft Azure backup solution rather than pulling your data back down and backing it up locally. And so that's a three-year cost estimate for using the Microsoft Azure backup that I got as well.
James, just so I can kind of track along here.
Yes.
The cloud cost, is that the only one you're estimating in a three-year block while the other ones are 1 year?
That's a great question. That's a great question. So this cost here is for the hardware along with a three-year service agreement with them. So they recommend that you have a service agreement with them that covers the software, the support, and any sort of hardware failure. So if there is a piece of equipment that fails in it, a hard drive or RAM or something, this is a next business day support agreement with them. So they will send you replacement parts. So it's a pretty good apples-to-apples comparison. It's a three-year total in everything included with the hyperconverged, as well as a three-year in the cloud. So it's everything that it would cost the city for 3 years with either solution.
So, I mean, from us being a customer, I guess, what happened here? Why is the cloud four times more expensive? What happened?
In my opinion, the Microsoft data center is super highly available, right? So they have lots of redundancies and large data centers and lots of expenses to run, right? And I think for very large customers, this might make sense for them, because if we were a very large entity, we would need a much larger server room, right? If we were a big company, right? And so it would cost us a lot of money to have a very large server room and provide cooling and backup and generators and all that sort of thing. So it would cost us a lot of money to mirror what Microsoft is doing. But that's not what we're trying to do. We have 14 servers, and we have a closet in the back of the police department, and we have very small needs. And so we're not trying to replicate what Microsoft is doing. we're trying to do something on a very much smaller scale. And so I just don't think what Microsoft and Amazon, you know, it comes up here a little bit cheaper, but I just don't think that we're trying to replicate the same thing that Microsoft's trying to do. And they have other pricing options as well, where you can not have it running 24/7. They have pay as you go, where you turn it on and then you turn it off and turn it on, turn off. But these servers that we have running, they're servers that we're using 24/7. We don't have servers that we turn off. We have the police department; they're here all the time. We can't just shut them off in the middle of the night or something like that. Like I said, some of these servers, we are looking where we can reduce our footprint and get rid of them where we can. But we're not going to scale down half. I mean, even if we were to cut this estimate in half, it's still more than the other option that I looked at.
James, you referenced earlier when you're going through our existing infrastructure that we have some systems that are in the cloud now.
Mm-hmm.
Who do we use and what do we pay for that?
Yeah, so let me go back to that list real quick. So what these are software as a service. So with these systems, the companies that make this software, they host it on their individual servers as part of the product that they provide. So think of it as, you know, you sign up for a Gmail account or whatever. Maybe it's a paid Gmail account, or you pay for some other service. You just pay them, and it's part of your monthly fee that you pay them, and they just happen to host it somewhere, wherever. So when we pay iCompass or GovQA, they might host it with Microsoft, or they might host it with Amazon, but we don't know that. We don't see that. It's just bundled into what we pay them for the monthly service. Or they might have their own Nutanix in their server room, and they host it themselves. We don't really know, because it's software as a service versus like a full server running in the cloud, which is what we're trying to do with some of these servers that we have that don't offer an option to run it as software as a service. So for example, our permitting software that we run right now, the vendor that we buy that from, they don't offer the version that we run to run it in the cloud as an option. If they did, that would be a good option to look at, running it in the cloud.
It looks like you looked at options that were all or nothing. It was either all new servers or all cloud. Did you look at anything in, is there some scenario in between where it makes sense to have some on a server and other stuff in the cloud?
I did look at that. So as small as we are, when I contacted Nutanix and Scale and Dell, and I said, hey, we're really small, what's the smallest thing that you can build for us? This is what they came back with. This is the smallest system that they could build, given the technology that they make. And so even at the smallest systems that they can build, it can run everything that we have. And so to me, if it can run everything, the 14 servers that we currently have, and even then some, there's a ton of room to grow with these systems, even as small as they are. We certainly could still run some stuff in the cloud, but then that would cost us money, where we already own the system to run it here, so why wouldn't we run it here when it's free? I mean, we've already paid for it, versus then pay on top of what we've already paid for to run some of it in the cloud. Any more questions?
I got 10, but I want to see your options.
Okay.
I want to see your recommendation.
Yeah. So just to show you all the details, which is probably more than you want, this is the quote that I won't call it a quote. This was an estimate from CDWG, who does a lot of our licensing, and you can see server 1 through 8, it just wouldn't fit on there, where they give you some details where it's going to be in the U.S. government, Arizona, and for simplicity, I just kind of used the same sizing of how many CPUs and RAM would come with each one, and they have the 730 hours. That's how many hours there are in a month, so they'll be up 24/7. And this was on the smaller side. I just kind of went for one of the cheapest ones. We might need a little bit bigger one for one server and a little bit smaller one for another. So this is kind of just the lowest end. And this is, again, the cheapest option is if you commit to them for 3 years. If you do pay as you go, then the price goes up a lot because they want you to commit to 3 years. So I was, again, looking for the cheapest apples to apples I could get. And then this AHB is, we've already purchased some of the Microsoft licensing that we need because we run the servers here. So again, this is the cheapest option where we're saying, well, we already own the licenses, so we'll just bring those with us. They have another option where you just, you don't have your own licenses and you pay them as part of the rental. You just rent the licenses as you use it. So there's the first 8 servers. Here's the other 14 servers. And then you say, well, I need some storage, so they add that on. And then they say, oh, you want to connect to your data. Here's another $433 to VPN and connect to your data. And then, oh, you want to transfer your, you actually want to transfer your data. We'll add a little bit on for that. And then support. So they kind of add on all these little things to connect to your data. And so this is where it came with the 3-year total with tax. And I just kind of rounded it down to $210,000 as a comparison. So that's where the numbers came from for the 3-year total. So just as a comparison, again, of the 3 hyperconverged solutions that I looked at, there's the Nutanix, the Scale, and the VxRail. You'll see that the Nutanix actually is a little bit more expensive than the Scale computing. But when you look at the hardware that they included, again, this is kind of getting in the nitty-gritty of it, but the Nutanix total processor cores came in at 60, usable 45, where the Scale was 24, usable 21.5. So you get a lot more value for what you're paying for. It's only a little bit more, but you get a lot more value. Again, the RAM is much higher. The total usable storage is higher. And then what a lot of it comes down to the support that you're getting, right? It's more than just hardware that you're buying. It's the support behind it. Also, not to leave out the Dell VxRail. I mean, for me, they came in above what my budget was, but it's also on the same side on what it's coming with. It's a lot lower on the components.
James, I'm not a computer guy. I know Dell. I've never heard of Nutanix or Scale Computing.
Okay, I have more slides about that.
What would we be buying? Dell's a known commodity.
Okay, I have a whole slide about it. Is that okay?
That's fine.
All right. So this chart might be a little bit hard to read up there, but I highlighted Nutanix in the upper right there. So this is a Magic Quadrant chart that's put together by a company called Gartner. They're an IT consulting firm. You could think of them like Consumer Reports for the IT field. And so, obviously, higher to the right is better. So they rate Nutanix at the top of their Magic Quadrant. Dell EMC is right up there, too, so they're not bad. Scale Computing is down here at the bottom left in their niche player. So they're coming up there, but they're not one of the top ranks. So Nutanix is a great company, according to Gartner. But I also want to show you, so this is Nutanix. These are Pacific Northwest customers. These aren't like all their customers. These are Pacific Northwest. This is a busy slide, so I'll point out some of them. Well, I have a slide separate, but there's a lot of companies in here. So these are municipalities in here. So City of Arlington, population 20,000, City of Sequim, 7,100, Tumwater, 2,300, City of Marysville, City of Redmond, City of Seattle, City of Vancouver. So these are just cities in our state that are using Nutanix, and they've seen the value in hyper-converged running systems locally and are using this exact platform. But you can also see it's used in the public sector, too. I mean, you got Nintendo and other large companies on here. F5 is a huge company, T-Mobile. So Nutanix is a very well-known company.
Tableau.
Oh,
I just got sold.
Yeah.
That's impressive.
So kind of to go back and just kind of give you a comparison, I think you probably figured out from the 2 different slides, but there's a big cost difference. And again, I just think it comes down to our scale of being a smaller city. We only have 14 servers currently. I didn't talk about it too much earlier, but the Nutanix system has tons of room for us to grow. So it's not that it only is the 14 servers that we currently run, but it has tons of room to grow. I mean, we could easily double the capacity of our current infrastructure and not pay another dime on licensing, on hardware costs, on storage space, on anything. with the Microsoft licensing, this is what it would cost to run what we're currently running today. If we add another server or any more storage, that cost is going to go up. So with the $65,000 and change, we got tons of room to grow. With the Microsoft Azure, the cost is going to go up as soon as we add more servers. And again, the Microsoft Azure is an estimate. I will readily admit that. That is a very ballpark estimate, but I don't think I am completely way off to think that that number could come down by $200,000 to be anywhere close to the Nutanix. So a little bit more about Nutanix, since, you know, it's not a very well-known name brand. So I first heard Nutanix when I was at a conference a couple years ago. City of Redmond was talking about it. They had bought the Nutanix system and couldn't stop talking about it, and so I started doing some research. So they were founded in 2009, 5,000 worldwide employees, publicly traded. They have 12,000 customers. They have a net promoter score of 92. So what does that mean? Nobody knows what that means. So some companies you may have heard of, you've heard of them.
That's good. That's a good score.
That's very good. So it's out of 100. Apple's score, so it's a rating of, your customer's willingness to return for another purchase and recommend them. So the industry average in technology is 54. Apple's score is 47. Sony's is 51. Costco's is 79. So this is like through the roof at the top. Great score. So this is how well do their customers think they treat them as a customer. So Marysville is a customer of theirs, and they had told me one day a package arrived on their doorstep, and it was from Nutanix, and they opened it up, and it was a replacement part. And they called them and said, what's this for? And they said, oh, well, our monitoring system showed that one of your hard drives is having some problems, and so we sent you a replacement. So they didn't even know that their system was having any sort of issues, and the Nutanix system reported back to headquarters. And so that's an example of the customer service that they get and the monitoring that they get and the proactive support to replace a part before the customer even knew that they had a part that needed to be replaced. So I'm very confident in talking to City of Marysville, City of Arlington. I went down to City of Redmond for half a day along with Marysville and Arlington. Before Marysville and Arlington bought it, we all went down to Redmond, looked at their deployment to see how it worked and to talk to them and see how happy they were with it. So I'm very confident that there's no problems with Nutanix as a company and that they stand behind their product. So that's all I have for you. If you have any other questions about the product.
I have a couple questions. Great presentation. I'm still not sure which one you recommend. No, I know which one you recommend. I can tell that pretty clearly. The two physical servers that we have right now, one and two, one of them is obviously warranty expires 2019. You're going to replace server two with the Nutanix, correct?
Yeah.
And you talked about the fact that the failure safeguards is an issue. So I take it if we move to one new Nutanix and we have a failure, there's a backup system built into that to keep us up, or how does that happen? Because now we're putting all our eggs in one basket.
I should have talked about that some more. So the way that the Nutanix system works is there's three, they call them three nodes. You get a minimum of three nodes, and they all talk to each other, and they all monitor each other. And they, as data is saved to the system, it is replicated across the three nodes for redundancy. And so any one of the three nodes can completely fail. And a node contains hard drive space, RAM, and computing power. It's basically three separate servers. A node is an individual server. And that data is all, like I said, copied to all three of them. And they're all redundant for each other. So you can have a complete node failure, and you don't lose any data or any operations. Those servers automatically boot back up. And any servers that were running on that particular node that failed automatically boot back up on the other two remaining operational nodes. And so that's where you get this highly, highly available, highly fault-tolerant system, rather than having to restore from a backup system or something like we are currently running. It just boots itself back up and keeps going. And then you rely on your next business day warranty through Nutanix. If you were to have a complete node failure, they will overnight you the replacement part. You swap out the node, and it rebuilds that redundancy very rapidly, and then you're right back where you were before.
So you could go down.
So no. So if you did have a full node failure, those servers within just a very short time will boot right back up on the other remaining nodes.
Okay, got it.
Yes, and the difference between our current system now is if this physical server were to go down, we do not have anywhere for those servers to boot back up to.
Yeah.
We have our data backed up, so the data is backed up, but we don't have anywhere to restore that data to.
My second last question. Obviously, physical server 2, we kind of getting out of it when we still have some life left in it.
Yes.
Is there any return that we can get on that? I mean, I know you buy the system, you probably don't get any money back there, but
right.
Any savings that we already have budgeted against that could be applied towards this new server?
I would have to double check with finance to see if we had put any money into like an equipment replacement fund or something like that, that could be applied towards this purchase. But the only other option we would have would be to, you know, consider it surplus like we've done with other equipment and maybe send it to auction and see if we could get a little bit of money for it. Off the top of my head, I believe we spent approximately $10,000 for this server, given that it's several years old and older technology kind of nosedives as its value.
Older technology's not worth.
Yeah, so, you know, it might be worth, you know, a couple $1,000 or maybe $1,000 if we're lucky.
Okay. Thank you.
Councilmember Vignal.
Thank you. Thank you, James, for your presentation. I'm not as up to date on all the computer technology, so I appreciate you breaking it down for us. I have a question because I was really surprised to see the amount that the cloud was going to be for us, because we were looking at that in my old job in North Carolina, and we were a small privately owned company. So if I'm understanding what you're saying right, so I just want to make sure that I'm understanding, we would need something different because we are a government entity, so we're going to need more detail with our backup and maintaining records, so it would cost more than if we weren't a government entity? Is that what you're saying, basically?
We would put our data in the government cloud. I don't think that there's a huge price difference between the standard public cloud and government cloud, so I don't think that is the big price difference. There's a lot of different options when you put your data in the cloud, so I'm not sure exactly what you were looking at it at the other location. But I think many times when you put something in the cloud, there's the one cost. There's the server cost, which is the big bulk of it. And again, these are three-year costs, not just one-year costs. But then there's also the costs that go along with it, right? The redundant internet connections, the cost to back it up, and sometimes those aren't always considered up front. They figure, well, I'll just run it on my Comcast internet, and that'll be enough. But I think for the type of services that we're running here, that we would need to consider all those other costs as well, and that's what also helps to drive up the price. I don't know if that answers your question.
Okay. I think so.
I was surprised as well that it was that much when I initially looked at it. I didn't think it was going to be quite that expensive. But I know I've talked to other cities. I talked to Snohomish County. They looked at running the cloud, running their stuff in the Microsoft cloud as well, and they told me a story when they got the quote. They said, wow, this looks great, let's do it. And then they realized it was the per month cost, not the annual cost. And so they're deploying a similar solution. It's not Nutanix, it's a different company, but they're doing basically the same thing that we're doing, just on a much larger scale to run their operations as well. So the counties went down the same path I did, looked at the cloud and found that it was much more expensive than they thought it would be and are gonna run a hyper-converged system.
Thank you, that's good to know.
Yeah.
Actually, I might be able to answer something on that, too, because a number of the companies I've been at, we have purchased operating systems that reside on the cloud. So we might be nationwide and have 20, 50 locations across the country. but the operating system that we're getting for our industry is a, as you said, a SaaS, a standardized operating system, so, or a software as a service, but a standard operating system on a SaaS platform. So it's not something that is created by us with different sub-servers that, like you articulate here for the finance database, and police file is something you don't find in too many businesses.
Yeah.
So it's a difference of, when you say cloud, there's different kinds of cloud applications, but what you're talking about is the server application for this government entity, with the kinds of services that we have, and you're parceling out particular ones because you got other ones that you've already purchased software for outside of this. So it's more of a customized approach, and when you customize in the cloud, it gets very expensive and
would not
make sense for us.
So these listed here, these SaaS services. These are usually run on a shared server with the other customers, right? So they can spread that cost over multiple customers, and the vendors can realize a lot of cost savings, right? These that we're running on our physical server, these are not types of systems that we would want to run on a shared server. So when we go to put these in the cloud, we're asking Microsoft to turn on a dedicated server that's just for us, and so that's part of what makes the cost go up as well.
Any other questions tonight? Thank you for your hard work on this. We're going to bring it back either the next week or the following week after the mayor's back and Councilmember Todd is back, so they have an opportunity to take a look at this and ask some questions.
Right. So,
James.
We're going to thank you, James.
Return now to the old business, and I think we had the answers in front of us the whole time. Did you come to that same conclusion?
Yes, as the song goes. But we also got some information from our finance director.
Yeah.
So on slide number 9, what should have been before the word interest was net interest cost.
Right.
This 1% assumes that we're going to invest whatever funds we have not yet expended and makes a presumption of a modest interest rate of 1.5%. So that this net interest cost, the what she has spread out here in the numbers, represents what we would be paying based on the funding that we've not yet expended. I don't believe it's spread out to reflect various rates at which the monies are drawn down, but it is the rough calculation that our finance director put together. So I apologize for not having the word net in front of the word interest cost.
I think the other answer is if you look in the clean copy of the ordinance that's in the agenda packet, there's an amortization schedule that's at the end of the ordinance. So if you turn to that for the ordinance that has the $3,322,000 bond amount, the initial payment of principal on that bond would be $231,000. The interest would be $31,972.40, and the total payment would be $262,972. If we went back to the ordinance that was presented to us last week at the $2,822,000 number, the initial payment would include only $195,000 of principal, $28,499.06 of interest, for a total payment of a little over $223,000. So the difference, the reason why the net interest is so low is because with the amortization schedule, the lower bond amount, we're paying back less principal. We're paying back $36,000 less in that initial payment.
That makes sense. It's a very good deal.
It is.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
Based on all the information that we have here, I would move to 2019-1851. Is that what the?
No, 851. 2019 ordinance. Amended ordinance 2019-851.
On that basis, I would make a motion to approve 2019-851.
And is there a monetary limit that you'd like to establish?
Well, let's get a second on the motion and then have that, because I have a couple questions too. Is there a second for that motion?
I'll second it.
Yeah, Scott, I had three questions. One, maybe this is just hyper-technical. Is it appropriate to call it an amended ordinance? To me, an amended ordinance suggests we're amending an ordinance we've already adopted.
Right. We actually had a bit of discussion about that in my notes and the recording from the last meeting were that you in fact adopted ordinance
2019-851
up to
yes.
the $3,500,000, whatever the high number was.
Okay, so that gets to the second question I had, which was, I don't know if the city manager is uncomfortable with this because it left the complete discretion to him. I don't have the red line up, that's why. I forget the section. It's in the bond, the section where it sets out the bond amount in.
Right.
If we were just to set the amount at $3,322,000, if that's the will of the council, can we just strike that sentence about the city manager is authorized to set the final amount? I mean, I assume the city manager wants direction from us as to what the amount of the bond should be, as opposed to making that in isolation.
I was trying to account for the city manager's filling in that blank, and I wanted to give the council the opportunity to select one of these three or some other alternative, and not knowing what it was, I decided to be prudent and do both. Now, it can be surplusage, and that's fine with me, as long as you specify the amount of the bond as part of the motion. And you can just move to approve the amended ordinance as presented in the amount of blank. And the city manager, I'm sure, will follow your direction when he fills out the application.
So I would guess I will add then the amount of $3,322,000 to the motion.
Is second in agreement with that?
Agreed.
The last question I had, this is also hyper-technical. It has the signature block for the mayor. Is it appropriate for her to sign since she is not here?
I didn't catch that, frankly, and Peg raised it with me, and it just got lost in all of the conversations that we had. It should be, this is an ordinance, and it should be signed, the ordinance should be signed by the mayor, but the city manager should be signing the bond funds.
Okay. I just want to make sure. Okay, those are all the questions I had. The motion and a second on the table. Any further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any oppose? Any abstentions? Motion carries. We'll move on to where are we at now? We've covered new business consent agenda. Item F, approval of checks number 60425 through 60510 and ACH wire transfers in the amount of $1,246,291.68. Audit committee, council members Bond and Vignol. Any exceptions?
No exceptions.
No exceptions.
And item G, payroll and benefit ACH payments in the amount of $214,841.61. Any exceptions?
No exceptions.
No exceptions.
And City Council meeting minutes of February 26, 2019. Do we have a motion to approve the consent agenda?
So moved.
Second.
Any further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, move on to reports. I'm going to channel Council Member Todd tonight and give a Todd-esque report. Got a few items. First, I had the privilege of going to speak to PAC, I think it was 122 last week, and talk about our city government, which I always enjoy doing, speaking to the scouts. Since I'm first, I'll just Council Member Vignol, myself, and who is Councilmember Todd? We're at the first meeting of the Mill Creek Boulevard subarea. I can't even remember the full name of the report, but we had our first meeting last week. I thought it was a very productive meeting. It's going to be a good work agenda, and I think the information we heard tonight from the Arts Fund will help provide some valuable input as that discussion moves forward. There's a couple items that I had the city manager include in the packet that I wanted to draw your attention to. It's under the item for the Snohomish County Steering Committee meeting information. At the very end of that, the last five or six pages, is that article from the Urbanist I referred to a couple meetings ago that talks about the impact. It's the issue of local control and what's happening with local jurisdictions taking things to restrict growth in their own communities and the impact that's having on the rest of us. So I think that's an interesting read. The second item, which is the bulk of that material, if you have a chance, it's fascinating to read. This was a presentation given to the Snohomish County Tomorrow Steering Committee by Todd Bridge, who's one of the foremost, if not the foremost, experts in the market data for housing and housing trends and data. And I think the main thing I want to draw your attention to, and I don't have the page numbers, I believe it was about pages 28 and 29, but it hits on the issues of affordability and the supply. And I think the most salient point to take from that is, historically, I can't remember the exact numbers, but in Snohomish County, unincorporated, leading up to the Great Recession, there was an average of, I think it was like 1,800 permits a year issued. That number in the Great Recession dropped dramatically. But what happened after the Great Recession is you also had about 3 or 4 years where there was virtually no applications for subdivisions or multifamily development. So while the population was still growing, businesses were still moving to this area, we were putting nothing in the pipeline to generate housing, to generate new housing, multifamily or single family, and we've never really caught up to that. And that kind of fits into the discussion that we had at the HART committee meeting, the Executive Summers Housing Affordability Regional Task Force meeting, which met for the second time last week. It was mainly more setting the ground, laying the groundwork and some background information. But one of the things that the main, there's a bunch of presentations that were given by a bunch of different housing organizations, Housing Hope and I forget all the other, there's 7 or 8 organizations all give about 5-minute presentations, all very good. But the bottom line came down to they all said we need more money. You know, there's going to be a property tax levy run here pretty soon, in this fall for dealing with the housing affordability issue. And these groups were talking about we need more funds from the state. But the point I brought up and that the Todd Bridge report hits on is if we don't do anything about the supply, all we're going to end up doing is going back to the state and asking for more dollars because the supply of housing is still going to be short and those costs are going to keep going up. And if the voters pass the property tax levy, the electeds are going to keep going back asking them to raise that because it does nothing to address the supply of housing, which is at the core locally of what's driving up housing affordability. We can't deal as much with the income inequality that is a tax issue and all sorts of other issues that are more at a higher level than we operate at, but it provides some context for the discussion that is going to be happening over the next 6 months at the HART committee. And that's it. That's all I had. Councilmember Bond, any report?
No report.
Councilmember Steckler?
Just a compliments to our team here, Meredith and the rest of your team, and Sarah, consultant on the Farmers Market next door. Nice job. A lot of good booth space, a lot of good attendance. You got a heck of a problem on your hand, though, because, Katie barred the door. I tried to find a parking spot today. It is horrible. I went all around trying to find a parking spot. You got to really want to go to that thing because you got to keep looking. I don't know what else we can do. I don't know what the solutions are. Maybe a location to consider for next year. But the good news is you got a lot of booths. Good news is you got a lot of people interested. Bad news is it's really hard to get to. So I know you're working on that, but compliments on the farmer's market. It was really nice to see. It was nice to see all the people there. Always great to see the community out. So kudos. That was it.
Councilmember Cavalieri?
I also wanted to throw a pat on the back to the farmer's market. I've received some really positive feedback from citizens and non-citizens that it's been successful so far. And even the folks in the parking lot, I asked them a few questions, and they were very excited to just – this is their second time here, so you're getting the repeat customers. So I think that's – we're doing something right. And last but not least is I noticed and this might go to the police chief, that we have a box that says free trigger locks for handguns out in the lobby. I think that's fantastic. I love to see us being proactive that way. I would love to see it somewhere on the website or blasting that information out there that we can let the public know that they can just walk through City Hall's doors, get a free lock for their gun, no cost, and maybe save one life. That's it. Thanks.
Great suggestion.
Councilmember Vignol?
I also was at the the first Mill Creek Boulevard sub-area committee meeting, and I thought it was a great start. I'm looking forward to it, and I thought they did a really good job of kind of getting everyone on the same page of where we are and kind of what the vision is as we start to move forward. So that was well appreciated. And also, the farmers market is great. Cora and I were out there today, and I agree. I got here at 2:30 to come down to City Hall and had to park all the way up at Central Market and walk down. So it was definitely lots of people here, which is a good thing. We just need to figure out how to accommodate them as we continue to grow. And good work to everyone, and especially the Kiwanis for their efforts to teach children about produce and bees today. So that was really nice, too. So thank you.
City Manager, anything on the planning schedule you need to highlight?
No, Mayor.
The Vision 2050, is that anything? Is that informational or?
It is informational. What we're putting together is a syllabus. The report at this point lays out what we're planning by way of information that can be brought to council sessions as well as opportunities for education elsewhere to attend for seminars. I know that Mr. Rogers and Ms. Hortolosa have worked very hard on putting together what was the outcome of the meeting we had with you as well as Councilman Todd, and hopefully that's a reflective of what we're working on. If there's something that is omitted from the report that you'd like us to pay attention to, we'll make certain to add that to it as far as the planning goes.
Okay.
And I did reach out to Mr. Rogers yesterday when I read the packet and told him to sign me up. So he's going to sign me up for the training in Mukilteo in September, I think it is. So it sounds like an excellent opportunity, and I would encourage others to look at going since it's going to discuss planning.
Great.
That brings us to audience communication. Last bite at the apple. Anyone want to speak to the council tonight?
I wondered why they were sticking around. We're ready for
ready.
You. We're done talking about sewers.
Excellent. And servers, and I spent all day in servers, so I'm happy about that.
Name and address for the record.
Hi, my name is Joanne Butewig, 2614 168th Street Southeast. And I am here to speak to the idea of a space, both for the economic gain, but for the community gain. I grew up in a community where theater and music and arts were a presence, a space we could go to. We gathered, and it evolved into programs and into opportunities for students, but also when they left high school. So we talk about the schools supporting, but we graduate them into leaving us. They're in Edmonds, they're going to Snohomish, or they're up in Everett. And so that ideal that our students could not only be active within our community, but beyond. We have capacity, we have need, we have desire. We have hundreds of kids participating in our school programs, but there's nowhere else for them to go. The summer is a great space. With where are they going? They have to leave our city in order to get somewhere, and I think that's really important. I was also sent with a message from Shari Bennett, one of our colleagues, and she wrote, "Life is heavy, life is hard. Theater gives participants the opportunity to leave their lives temporarily and become someone else who evokes responses from the audience. The actors give love, hope, and sorrow, but it's not their emotion, it's the theater's. It's a safe space for lost souls to come and find commonality like nothing else. They find bravery, courage, and a community. We have seen youth who could not speak, look up, find us and their passion, and go on to succeed. And we believe our adults need that as well. So that needs to be a public space in which we can use. We cannot fit into our spaces in our schools. We cannot do the kind of work we have to leave. Our chorale needs to perform in Edmonds. It's called the Mill Creek Chorale, but it has to find a performing space outside our city. So we applaud your recognition of the arts, and we hope that in the planning that is a consideration. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else desire to speak to the council? Name and address, please.
My name is Jennifer Jarrett. My address is 15303 33rd Drive, Southeast Mill Creek. I actually grew up right in this community. I was in the first graduating class of Heatherwood Middle School, and I remember the days when we didn't even have a library. We just had a bookmobile. It was so exciting when we got a library. And I really, I grew up here, then I was away during my college years, and then I'm back now with my family raising my three children here for the last 12 years or so. And I have three children that all participate in the arts at various levels. My son plays violin, my older daughter loves to perform in musical theater, and my other daughter loves to dance. And my family spends thousands of dollars every year on the arts, participating as performers, but also consuming the arts. We go to Seattle, we go to Bellevue, we go to Snohomish, we go to Linwood. We very rarely get to spend our dollars in Mill Creek, but we would happily if there was an opportunity, if there was a performing space and programs for our children to participate in. My daughter dances at Applause Dance School right here in Mill Creek, and they have a great program there, but every year thousands of dollars go outside of Mill Creek for those, their big recitals that we usually go to Snohomish, I think, for those. And that's money being lost that could belong to our city. And it makes it more convenient. My daughter wants to say something about that because she wishes her friends could come see her performances. I just think a performing arts center would be just such a great next step in Mill Creek's history. It's been such a wonderful community that I have grown up in, and I'm so happy my family's here now, and I want to see it continue to thrive, and I think that would be a great next step for our community.
Thank you. Thank you. Name and address, please. There you go.
Hello, my name is Chloe Jett, and I'm a dancer at Applause Studio. And every time we have a recital, we always have to drive up to Snohomish. And it makes all of our family and friends, like they all live in different states, so it takes a very long time to drive up to Snohomish. And half of my friends that dance with me don't even live in Mill Creek. So it takes about like 2 hours for them to get up to Snohomish. And it would be really awesome if we had a performing arts center in Mill Creek.
Thank you. Anyone else? Going once, twice, three times. The council will now recess to executive session to discuss the potential acquisition of real estate pursuant to RCW 42.30.110, subsection 1B, and to discuss potential litigation pursuant to RCW 42.30.110, subsection 1i, and action may or may not be taken. Is 8:30 going to be enough time?
We're planning that.
Awesome. We'll move into executive session now.
Thank you.
Yeah, hopefully we'll see you when we get the slideshow in a couple of weeks.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
All right.
Can I take it back?
Yeah.
I'll bring it. We have priority.